Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 17 of Ludonarrative Dissidents, a role-playing podcast about games, how they're made, and how they're played. I'm James Wallace, and with me, as always, are Ross Payton and Greg Stolze, my stalwart co-hosts. I wouldn't describe them as squires. We are all equals here. Today, we are discussing Pendragon, one of the venerable classic role-playing games, arguably the masterwork of the master designer Greg Stafford, the man behind RuneQuest. This is the first edition that was completed and published without his final sign-off. Sadly, Greg died in 2018, and although he was working on this edition at the time, he did not, obviously, stick around to put his final signature on it. Greg, are you familiar with Pendragon?
This was my first time reading it. The great impression Pendragon made on me was when I was talking to a friend and game designing publisher, and he's like, "Oh, I'm about to start a new campaign of the greatest game ever made." And I said, "Oh, which implementation of the one roll engine is it in that that writerly way that's two-thirds joking and one-third desperate plea for approval?" And he said, "No, Greg, it's Pendragon." And I'm like, "It's that good?" He's like, "Listen, man, I love your work, but this is Pendragon."
Certainly, it has zealots among its fan base. Really, people who will get, I mean, most role-playing games do, but Pendragon fans are you know, evangelistic about it in a mm-hmm. way that few are. Certainly, when it came out in the early to mid-80s, it was almost unprecedented for the way that it blended mechanics with theme. And the theme, of course, is King Arthur. it's a heraldic, chivalric, knightly life in a kind of hand-wavy era of English history that might be the mid-6th century or might be sometime sort of vaguely after the Norman Conquest, depending on which Arthurian text that you're actually following on this. It's kind of based on the Mort d'Arthur, the Malory, though actually, I mean, like an awful lot of 20th and 21st century Arthurian texts, it's actually really based on The Once and Future King by T.H. White, which has kind of become our understanding of the Arthurian story, not least because Disney adapted it, or the first volume of it, to become The Sword in the Stone, which is where most of us first came across the stories of King Arthur, even if we've read them and watched them many, many times subsequently, from everything from the movie Excalibur to the Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the musical Camelot, and the movie First Night, starring Sean Connery and Richard Gere, which a friend of mine was in. We won't go into that. Mostly drawing on that tradition of kind of, it's England is split into many separate kingdoms, but at the same time, everyone's wearing really very advanced armor. Doesn't make any historical sense at all, but is still such a fertile bed for stories generally.
In the playtest single, the solo quest that I played through, it's like, "Oh no, man, it's Picts. These guys are just out there raw dogging battle. They're wearing paint, man."
Yeah,
they're wearing paint and waving
this
pointy
is a,
sticks.
A mythic interpretation of history, you could say. It is. Yeah, a melding of fact and fiction rather than trying to be in a particular time. It's not the opposite of Call of Cthulhu, right? It's not like trying to be a particular exact year or whatever. It's to getting the feel of, a myth cycle.
Yes, completely. And just before we go any further, let's make it clear what we're talking about here specifically is the 6th edition starter set, which at the time of recording is all that has been released for the 6th edition. Barring there's a quick start set of rules that you can download for free off Drive-Thru and other places. But so far, the main rules for 6th have not come out. So while those of us who have read earlier editions may be referring back to them, what we're talking about here is specifically the starter set. And being a starter set, it is not a complete set of the rules. It is missing huge chunks of the stuff that you would expect to find in a role-playing game, like character generation, but also missing some of the stuff that is integral to the heart of what makes Pendragon work, specifically the dynastic stuff. Because if you're not aware of it, one of the things that's at the heart of it is that Pendragon is a game in which your PC, your central knight, may die of old age and pass, or, you know, or heroically in battle, but they may have descendants who will pick up the title, pick up the sword, put on the over-elaborate armor, and go out and continue the quest. The Great Pendragon Campaign, the massive multi-award-winning volume which Greg did write, which won the Diana Jones Award, I forget which year it was, that takes 85 years of game time, and this is not a game with elves and dwarves in it. So that's about three generations of player characters to complete the whole thing, basically the entire Arthurian cycle.
So, like, if you were playing once a week, which is pretty ambitious in of itself, that's like a year and a half, right, of playing straight through.
Yes, because it's one of the other things it does, which we will get onto, is it was one of the first games to do the kind of the year cycle and introduce the idea of downtime, because, you know, heroic knights don't go out in the wintertime because the roads are muddy and the days are short and everyone is staying at home trying to conserve food. So
and winter you'll is catch basically your death of cold, which is not a glorious way to die.
Uh-uh. It's not, particularly if you're encased in steel. You know, you're going to be leaching body heat at the rate of knots.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, winter is downtime. And so each play session is a year, or that's the way it's kind of structured, or each scenario is supposed to be a year. And then you have downtime and you do the downtime stuff. And this was picked up by Ars Magica, which we've discussed in the late 80s. And then other games just took it and ran with it. And now the whole idea of downtime between adventures is something that's just part of the role-playing vocabulary. It was a groundbreaking piece of design when it came out. It was doing things that it took a lot of other designers a long time to pick up.
When was the last time either of you played an ongoing role-playing game campaign where everything that happens in session? There's no downtime. There's very little fast forwarding. It's like, okay, so we ended at 5 o'clock on Friday with the drugstore on fire. And next week we pick up at 5:10 and the drugstore is still on fire, but now the fire department's shown up. What you doing?
Oh, that's
when was the last time you played one like that?
Not as a campaign. Yeah, I don't know, because like the last campaign, my most recent campaign is Delta Green Impossible Landscapes, which has a 20-year gap between certain sessions. So that is definitely disqualified. I don't know. Spoiler for Impossible Landscapes, but yeah, there is a 20-year gap between one section.
I can't even bring myself to read it now.
Oh no, it's a good book. It's a fascinating read on its own. Yeah, I don't know if I've ever had a campaign that had no downtime.
Oh, and see, you were talking before we started recording about how you're constantly flitting from system to system because you're so jaded, and I'm like, this is going to be the next thing, is everything that happens in sesh.
Well, the problem is, like, almost every role-playing game has downtime in some way. Characters eventually have to stop doing things because they've run out of some kind of resource, right? Like, even in D&D, you have to rest to get your spells back or get your hit points back. Like, you basically, the thing is, the players keep going until they're too bloody and broken to stop, keep going. So, like, they have to heal up eventually.
So, yes, but in D&D, you're not healing for an entire season.
That's true. You're not. And like this idea, that's one of the things that really strikes me about Pendragon is the yearly cycle. And it is a fascinating thing because like I've been thinking of my longer campaigns. Yeah. Having a campaign where you get to see the year after year impact of your actions is fascinating. And for me, the thing about the first thing I think about Pendragon is the Pendragon cycle, because that's one of like the three campaigns that people bring up as the best campaigns that have been ever written: Masks of Nyarlathotep, Enemy Within for Warhammer Fantasy, and the Great Pendragon campaign or cycle. And like those are it. Those, like, everything that those are put on pedestals, and such a high standard. And like, that's, yeah. That's the first thing I think of when I think of Pendragon is that like Greg Stafford nailed it back in the 80s. And we've all been just copying him ever since.
As an aside.
Yeah.
Do you know where he went to college?
No.
Nope.
Beloit. Beloit Ooh. College, where my wife took her new job, meaning that I moved here in order to become the second most renowned role-playing designer from this town named Greg. But, you know, that doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
That's a, you know, take your glory where you can.
Yeah. At least you're not moving. You didn't move to Lake Geneva. That would be a little harder still. I think the thing that reading this, the rules, like my overall impression of Pendragon is that like what Greg Stafford figured out back in the 80s is, you know, this idea of like, you know, our podcast is called Ludo Narrative Dissonance, which is a play on Ludo Narrative Dissonance, which is the idea that you say your game is thematically about this, but it's really about something completely different. And that creates a dissonance, right? Like, I'm trying to solve a murder and I'm going to kill a lot of people to solve this murder and get justice. I'm like, well, exactly. Yeah. And what Pendragon does is like, no, we're going to cut out as much dissonance as possible and unify themes and mechanics into one concept that everyone can grasp. And like, everything is about this unity of mechanics and theme. And it does so in a brilliant way, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, completely.
Can I digress heavily into a metaphor about like late 80s comics?
Sure. Okay. As long as you wrap it up and bring it back, go.
So what Pendragon made me think of is Jaime Hernandez compared to Todd McFarlane, because I remember someone, an artist comparing these two comics artists and saying that, you know, Todd McFarlane looks like if the guy in your high school who was the best artist in high school kept at it for like 5 more years pretty seriously. And, you know, his art's good. It's fine, but it's graspable. Mm-hmm. You can imagine that if you stuck with it, you could get that good. You can see how it's done. And he compared this with Jaime Hernandez, who is much less popular than Todd McFarlane was. They were in the 80s, you know, Todd McFarlane was making way more money with Spawn than Hernandez was with Love and Rockets. Mm-hmm. But he's like, if you look at his work, it's very clean, straightforward, seems simple. And yet, if you try to recreate it, you just can't. You just can't. And I remember him pointing out one panel where this large boulder that occupied a fair amount of the panel was all black. And he's like, any other artist who does an all black boulder, it's not going to look like a rock. But this one does, for some reason that Jaime Hernandez and the viewer understand and no one else does. And the suggestion was that when you look at one of Jaime Hernandez's covers, to add a single line would diminish it, and to remove a single line would diminish it. And that was kind of the vibe I picked up from the core Pendragon rules, is that there is nothing missing. There is nothing extra.
Yeah. It's a superlative piece of work. Just looking at the character sheet is so often I go over character sheets and it's just, oh God, there are so many numbers. What does this mean? I'm going to have to read the rules for this section. But you look at a Pendragon character sheet, and if you're familiar with role-playing games, you can basically go, I understand this character and this is an interesting character. Because it's interesting because the system is basically basic role play. It's the Chaosium in-house system that's evolved over the years and also powers Call of Cthulhu. And we've talked about it before in the context of the COC and the Laundry Files and a whole bunch of others. But it has this beautiful stuff built on top of it seamlessly, including a system of traits, including virtues and vices, passions, does away with the idea of experience points. You're after glory. And the reason all of this works is because you're a knight at the court of King Arthur. And you, there have been earlier editions that allowed you to be wizards and stuff.
In this would never work for Call of Cthulhu in a million years.
Oh.
I didn't think it looked that... It's kind of like BRP, but it's D20 based rather than percentile based, which I feel like I feel that feels different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's like somebody has just, you know, taken a production model car and completely retooled the engine until it absolutely purrs and hums and will burn you off at the lights and just leave you choking in dust. It's a superb piece of retooling. And it absolutely creates characters who are not only feel knightly and bound by the chivalric code, but who are all different, and they have things that they want to do, things that they don't want to do, things that they have to do, things that they mustn't do. And that's all tied in mechanically as well. It's really a lovely piece of work. And I'm trying to leaf through a PDF to find actual words from the character sheet that will describe
this. This is the problem. It's one of those things that's so good it's hard to analyze.
Mm.
It's hard to find the edge where you can get your fingers in, pry the casing off, and start figuring out how it do what it do. That was my experience with the novel South of the Border, West of the Sun by Haruki Murakami.
Mm-hmm.
I was an English major. I went to grad school. Literary analysis. Okay, I have those skills. So most books that I like, I can sort of disassemble it and say, well, this is why I liked it so much, and this is why I didn't like it, and this is what I didn't like, and this is what I think the author could have done better. But Murakami's work, for some reason, is just resistant to my analysis. I'm like, I shouldn't have liked this book. I shouldn't have liked the fact that the author relentlessly presented the main character as cooler than me. I should not have been interested in this narrative about a man reconnecting with his childhood girlfriend. And yet, it's fascinating. There was another one of his books where I'm like, this scene is absolutely terrifying me. It was in Sputnik Sweetheart, and I could not figure out why I was so frightened. So this is a little like this. It resists analysis.
Well, I don't know.
It does like, use the future tense, though.
Yeah.
That burned me.
Oh, no. One thing to keep in mind is...
Come on. You were supposed to be the chosen one, Stafford.
Yeah.
I think we're going to come on to that, because I have some things to say about that as well.
This is the sixth edition of a game, so I think this is, one thing is this is a very mature game where, so many years and feedback, and this is a game that people clearly... Stafford and the other people who've worked on it, David Larkin is the line developer for this. I think his hand is guiding this more than anything else. But there's a large team for it. There's a lot of playtesters. So there's this, everything has been tested over and over again. And people know this rule leads to this kind of result in play. And so I feel like this edition, they're tweaking things to hone it to a fine polish. So
yeah. Anything that five separate people would have tripped over was noticed in 2006.
So yeah. Mm. But yeah, please.
Yes. So it's just a sideline briefly. I mean, you mentioned it's on the sixth edition. It's also its fifth publisher, or technically its fourth publisher. It started off with Chaosium, obviously. Who did the first edition, and then the second, I think the second edition never actually came out, but the third edition as well was also Chaosium, and then it went to Green Knight, it went to White Wolf, it spun off from White Wolf to Nocturnal, and then it went back to Chaosium. And that's a lot of publishers. I mean, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay has also had five publishers, and one fewer edition. But the difference is that Greg Stafford was the guiding hand through all the editions so far, including sixth, because you can very much feel his influence. His pen for an awful lot of it. Just to go back to the characters and the character sheets, just looking at the ones in the starter set, they call them character folios. They are two pages. The first page contains no game information. No, a very, very small amount of game information. It starts off with your character's coat of arms and their motto, and then how old they are and where they're from, a little bit of history, and a big picture.
I really like the art on these.
Oh, it's great. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming it's new for this edition. I don't know.
Oh, it's gotta be. Yeah.
But the tone of the art throughout is absolutely bang on. I think we'll talk about layout probably later. But anyway, but then the second sheet is your character stats. So you've got your skills, you've got your characteristics, which are the BRP ones. But then you've got the traits, and the idea of a trait is that they're a matched pair. Each has its own value, but they will always add up to 20. So you can have chaste and lustful are a pair. So if you've got chaste at 13, you have lustful at 7. And there will occasions where you will have to roll against both of them to see if you can resist something, if you can stay on the path that you have chosen for yourself and not steer over into the other one. And they are very in tune with the setting, not just with the heraldic knights, but the whole tone of that sort of medieval literature and T.H. White as well. So there's also energetic and lazy, forgiving and vengeful. I was on holiday last week. I found myself thinking about a game system which involved the seven deadly sins. And as so often in my career, a few hours later, slapped myself and went, I have just reinvented Pendragon, the game I was reading before I came on holiday. Because it's not strictly, there's more than that. There's, I think he says, counting very quickly, 12, 14 pairs of traits. But they are based very much on this kind of, it's interesting, the game doesn't talk about Christianity very much, but there's clearly elements of the Christian worldview in there, you know, which again fits with the setting. This is ludonarrative.
That the spiritual and the worldly are in competition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That you can be one or not, but not both. Yeah, this was what another game designing friend of mine hated most about Pendragon. As soon as I mentioned I was going to be talking about it, he's like, oh, I played that. It was miserable. And I'm like, really? I rarely hear anyone say bad things about Pendragon. And he's like, yeah, it's like, oh, you want to act like a decent human being? Well, you better roll on your decent human being trait. And he also had complaints about how passions worked, that it was really, really easy to go mad or become melancholic in order to get a plus 10 bonus on one roll. That was his beef, was that it deprotagonized him, right? That you may have, that because you decided to set your character's honesty very high, when the time comes to lie, you may not be able to bring yourself to do it, even if it is otherwise perfectly in character for your character to lie. And, you know, he felt that this should be something. He did not like giving moral decisions to the dice. And, you know, I can certainly see where that's coming from. In a lot of my own design work, I'm like, the one thing that, even in superhero games where there's like mind control and whatnot, or unknown armies where people can affect your behavior, it's usually presented as either, oh, yeah, you know, your body has been taken over and is being puppeted and you can't do anything about it except watch. And that's presented as this horrible, nightmarish violation. Or it's, oh, yeah, you know, this is affecting your emotions and you really, really, really want to do X. And the player's like, well, do I have to do X? No, you could choose to not do X. It'll cost you. You may not want to pay the cost to resist doing X, but you can always do it. Your enemies cannot force you to do anything except die. They cannot make you decide to do X. They cannot change your opinion about Y. Whereas Pendragon, and you do pick what your traits start at, but it's largely, you know, the dice can have a big effect on what your personality is. And the other designer I talked about, the one who was like, you know, it's the greatest game ever written, loves Delta Green, where you are rolling to see if you maintain control of yourself, if you flip out, if you, you know, go have a psychotic break or some kind of profound emotional breakdown. So one guy who loves games where the dice may deprotagonize you for the for horror or for drama loves Delta Green and Pendragon. The other guy was a D&D designer where it's like, no, you can't. I might, you know, have to take a saving throw to avoid being dominated into suggestion, but I don't have codified, mechanized personality traits.
No, nothing on the character sheet about personality at all.
Which means that the D&D players have perfect character freedom in a way that an unknown army's character does not.
Or a Pendragon character, yeah.
Oh, certainly not a Pendragon character. And, you know, a lot of the D&D stuff, it's like, oh, I am lawful good, but I am going to choose to torture these unarmed captives for information. But I'm still lawful good. That doesn't sound very lawful good to me. Well, but it's for the greater good, and I'm legally allowed to do it. Mm. And so, you know, some versions have, you know, it's like, oh, I think you may have just slipped from lawful good towards lawful good with some neutral tendencies. And you keep up like this, you're going to be lawful neutral or maybe even neutral evil. And then the players get, but it's not mechanized. There aren't numbers attached to this, and the player may get extremely defensive, like, no, 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 I'm lawful good.
Yeah.
No matter how many awful things I do.
Yeah, that's true. Because like at the heart, D&D is not interested in this issue. It's not interested more in dilemmas. It's interested in tactical monster slay. Whereas Pendragon, right. There's literally a thing in the adventures talking about how captives are kept and what the moral dilemma is. It's about, it's all about the moral dilemma in Pendragon. That's what the game's about. If you don't care about these moral dilemmas, then yeah, Pendragon's not going to appeal to you. If you're not interested in being scared, Delta Green's not going to appeal to you. Like that's, yeah. And that this is what I'm talking about, the thematic unity.
I feel that might be unfair. I mean, you know, you've heard my opinions.
You don't get to choose your emotions in real life. Like, emotions happen to you.
That's true.
And so, like, it's Pendragon. These are passionate characters. These are people who are brimming with energy and ideals and literally passions. And, like, that's the and the whole game is about, like, Arthur's vision for a better world, right? Like, it's about building a better Britain, about building creating peace and create and making something, and that struggle versus our earthly flaws. Can we, you know, I mean, Arthur's, you know, a very Christian thing about like, can we resist sin and do the right thing? Or are we doomed to failure? And like, but is it worth trying? Like, it's answering these big questions and like, That's what it's about.
I hate to saddle up under the banner of defending Dungeons and Dragons because I feel it has many, many very able defenders. Mm-hmm. But saying that it is disinterested in moral dilemmas,
it is,
probably does. I've got a statement.
Okay.
I've got an argument to advance.
All right. All right.
That should be complete. That should be completed before you demolish it. There are many groups who I'm sure are extremely interested in moral dilemmas, and I've played D&D with the, oh, well, you know, you can save A or B, but not both, and that suspension, even unmechanized, is just as suspenseful as it is in a game like Pendragon, where you are going to, you know, it's like, oh, this will decide if I get a tick on my just box or my arbitrary box. Just because an aspect of role play is not mechanized doesn't mean it can't be present. And I'm sure that in many D&D games, it isn't, because they aren't interested in creating psychodramas. Psychodrama is necessary in Pendragon, and that's why it's mechanized.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that psychodrama is therefore absent in every game that doesn't mechanize it, because people love that stuff. It's
sure.
it's central to many of the stories we tell.
It, so yeah. There. Most yeah. of them probably, if you looked at them, but I would say when I say D&D is not interested, I mean like the rules, the text, like, cause as you were just describing the Ludo narrative dissonance of being like, I'm lawful good and I get to execute prisoners because it's lawful and I say I'm good. Therefore.
Well, and the argument there is that D&D should never have had alignments.
Well, then, yeah, but we're not talking about what it should be. It's what it is. And it says it has alignments, but then it doesn't have anything like Pendragon's complexity of traits and passions and the conflict between honor and glory, for example.
It's got alignments. They just don't have any spines or teeth.
Yeah, exactly. That. Yeah.
For some characters, it does. I mean, the closest thing that D&D has to an Arthurian knight is the paladin, who has to be lawful good. And if he varies, or she varies away from being lawful good, they cease to be a paladin, which is always really interesting. But whether they move away from being lawful good is GM fiat. There are, as you say, no mechanics
yes.
there. But I think it comes down to the nature of tragedy for me, almost. Mm-hmm. Tragedy in D&D is kind of you attempt to do something and you fail and things go badly from there. Pendragon, it starts with you are faced with a dilemma. You feel you should do something that is against what you would normally do or against your chivalric code. You attempt to do that, to force yourself to do it, and you find yourself unable. So it's much more about personal tragedy rather than plot tragedy. And I think that's fascinating. In a game from the mid-80s, we're talking 10 years after the form was invented. This is brilliant and stands up so well.
Yeah, and that explains why you have randomized traits, because it's a game of personal tragedy, because you don't always get to say.
Your traits aren't randomized. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, like, the rolling.
You set your traits
yeah.
and then roll against them. So the dice decide, but the dice decide the tactics of your personality while you've decided the strategy of your personality.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tragedy because, like, you could say my character is honest and then, but then I roll to lie and, like, or it will be terrible if I can't lie this one time and it's okay. Like, my king has given me permission to lie or whatever it is, the circumstances, but yet I still can't do it. And there's the tragedy. There's the flaws. These are flawed knights, you know, like, that they cannot overcome their passions or their traits. So,
or their loyalties.
Yeah.
Something that the setting reminded me of. And this is, again, because what I've said, it does really, really well and in a very spare, fatless way, is link your themes and your setting and the vibe of it all to the mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
What it reminded me of is sort of the samurai approach of total loyalty and this fanatical devotion to the Lord. And mm-hmm. there's, you know, this bit about, okay, so who is the better samurai? The one who loyally serves a good lord or the one who loyally serves a bad lord? And the answer is the one who serves the bad lord, the one who commits the atrocities when ordered to, even though he despises them, because his first, best, foremost duty is loyalty and obedience.
Hmm?
And, you know, and this seems extremely weird to those of us living in the 20th century, but these warrior ethos settings, you know, that this was certainly something that the people giving the orders very much wanted, very much tried to inculcate as a value. And I'm sure that the boots on the ground, it was a little looser than is presented in the records and the training manuals and the primary source documents of the time, that, you know, your Lord might command you to do something that you find vile, disgusting, and beneath you. And the question is, okay, well, do I do it or not? Can I stand to do it or not? Can I stand to betray my lord by defying his order? And these are very compelling questions, and I'm sure make for a lot of really intense play if you can keep yourself to the vibe.
Yeah.
And I think it would be hard to play Pendragon well in the 21st century because we have become, in many ways, a culture of smartasses, right?
I don't think that's fundamentally changed since the 80s, like when it first came
out. Yeah, probably not. Yeah. But all I know, what was the weapon that's like a Frankish, it's like a throwing axe? Ooh. And I'm like, I know that if I was playing this game and I had a character who had one of those, at some point I would try and throw it to someone's crotch saying, "I just franked your beans, son." And that is not chivalric because I'm not chivalrous. It would be, I'm sure, I don't know. What do you guys think? Is it possible to play Pendragon as with the thematics of an early Beastie Boys album? Or does it have to be, Morte d'Arthur? Oh, man, I butchered that, didn't I?
Pretty much. I think you can. I mean, role-playing games are inherently about being somebody you're not, whether in terms of what you can do or the way you approach the world. And it started off, D&D characters. It's interesting. For a project, I've been rereading S1 Tomb of Horrors, the early classic killer dungeon. And there's an assumption in there. Because when I started role-playing, it was just me and the GM because we didn't have many friends and they weren't interested. Ooh. It was the early 80s. What was this role-playing thing? So I played the entire party, and I thought that was an aberration. But S1 Tomb of Horrors assumes that each player will have multiple characters. They're tools, they're puppets, they're not, you don't embody them, you don't necessarily, inhabit them as an actor would inhabit a role in any... Well, you certainly wouldn't in Tomb of Horrors, because they're not going to last more than a few minutes.
your average character in Tomb of Horrors is slightly less shelf-stable than a loaf of bread.
Yeah, so there was this assumption in the early days of role-play that your characters were basically tools, and I've talked way too much about it's the wargaming attitude, which it was changing, but it hadn't changed to the modern assumption, which is one player, one character, pretty much.
I still see games where people have multiple characters, but you are right. The assumption is definitely one-to-one. And I don't think that arose from designers saying, oh, what is most desirable in this instance is a one-to-one character-to-player balance so that a deep emotional parity can be achieved. No, I think what happened is that people liked focusing on their guy, that they would play this character and they would get into it and they would ride the bleed and have fun and be like, I cannot wait till the next game when I get to act out like Chunk style again and say things unguardedly and solve my problems with violence. That's sweet times. Mm-hmm. And if you're acting out with Chunk style, then having a secondary character who's a wily smartass thief is not necessary. It's not going to enhance your Chunk style experience. It's just going to dilute it. You're going to be like, no, I want to be in the fun guy all the time. I don't want to have to mentally extract myself from Chunk style in order to get in this other suit of emotional clothing that gives me niche protection that the party needs. There was probably feedback between players who wanted deeper and deeper into a single character, and many of them whom probably became designers who set up mechanics where it's like, okay, well, if you want to get deeper and deeper into a character, let's mechanize those depths. Let's give you a madness meter in Unknown Armies, or give you a demeanor and nature in the World of Darkness. I mean, certainly that's something I've been enthusiastically doing for decades.
Let's go backwards. Let's talk about the layout. The book, the at least certainly the starter set, the books of the starter set are presented as if they are a medieval manuscript. Stylized, of course, and the body text is a lovely serif font, but it's got the lines that a medieval manuscript would have, dividing the text up into boxes. It's got illuminated capitals at the start of each chapter. It's got little marginalia illustrations taken, I think, actually from medieval manuscripts.
Those are the best.
Or redrawing of medieval manuscripts. Oh, yeah.
I love those marginalia. I would fight a biker for those marginalia.
Yeah. It's so good. It is beautifully, beautifully presented. And yet, with all of that, their columns are frequently not balanced. And it's just...
I'm sorry, James. I know. Yeah. I know how much that... It's a pain. This is what it sounds like when doves cry, James.
Yeah.
The starter set might have been rushed. But yeah, it's hopefully the full book.
What's the rush? This game is from the 80s.
Gotta get the starter set out for Gen Con in time for Gen Con.
I suspect that was probably it. There are a couple of moments in here where I just felt that needed one more pass. Yeah. There is a moment in the adventure which we'll come on to. It's a starter set. There's a bunch of stuff in the box, but the three fundamental books are a big solo adventure, which introduces the mechanics as you go through it and starts you off as a squire, and then you become a knight. And then there's the rules, or the cut-down version of the rules, and then there is the sword campaign, which is in four parts, I believe.
Well, there's three adventures.
Three adventures.
It's called the sword campaign because it's like the beginning of the great Pendragon campaign. It's about Arthur getting his sword, becoming a king, and being witness to it.
Getting his two swords.
Yes.
And so that he can dual wield.
Yes. For those who are unfamiliar with that, the sword in the stone is not Excalibur. And the number of arguments I've had about this is like, no, I've written a book about this. because I should say at this point that the first role-playing supplement I ever wrote was for Palladium's After the Bomb series. And the brief I was given by Kevin Simbida was... It's the UK, it's after the bomb, all the animals have mutated into humanoids, the humans are the bad guy, and King Arthur's back. And so I wrote an Arthurian post-apocalypse setting for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So the reason I mention this is I've been here, I have thought specifically about telling the Arthurian cycle, or at least the first part of it, within a role-playing context. And I have notes on the way that the Pendragon starter set handles it. Specifically, the solo adventure starts off with you as a squire in the same household as the young Arthur, and takes you through and introduces you to the mechanics and all the rest of the setting as well, and the family and stuff, and ends at the moment where you're standing beside Arthur as he pulls the sword out of the stone and is proclaimed king. And then you get to the first adventure in the book in which you are not this character. And it basically retells that bit of the story again. It's your part of it. You're a squire in a different household going to London for this big tournament. And you bump in, you spend a day in London, you bump into Merlin and stuff, and then the tournament starts. And the same incident, Arthur pulls the sword out of the stone, only you don't know Arthur at that point. So there's no flow. Surely what you should have done is taken the solo and then had the first adventure. But onto that. And it's weird. The other thing that the first adventure does is it does not foreground the characters. The characters are watching history. They are not necessarily, they are present, but there's at no point do they feel that they're at the center of it. Role-playing games are about putting your character at the center of it. You are the hero. You don't have to be the main person, but you have to be involved in that action.
Well.
And there's a lot of bits where you're watching things, and you choose sides, and Arthur recognizes and calls on you later on. But I ran through it with my youngest and one of her school friends, and they are young teens. They're familiar with Arthur in the way that young teens are. I don't think they've ever read any of the books. It's not a story that they know well, and they were quite excited by it. And they just, I could watch them not being drawn into this narrative. And I thought it was, they liked the characters, they liked the tournament, they liked the sense of medieval London and joshing around and even having their pockets picked and chasing the pickpocket. That was fun. And they had a very brief encounter with Merlin, because at one point you're supposed to see Merlin across the street and someone goes, oh, there's Merlin. And I beefed that up a bit simply because, yeah. I felt it needed another pass. Let's put it that way. I would have done it differently. In fact, I did do it differently. I'm not going to go into the long description of how I did it, but the thing I always try and preserve when I'm writing a role-playing adventure is that the character's actions matter to the main story to an extent. And if the character's actions don't matter, there has to be a reason for that. And there was a sense of kind of in this of almost of history happening, and you could have missed it. If you turned the other way and gone, no, everyone's going this way, I'm going to go over there. This is, you know, distracted by a pretty girl or pretty boy or pretty horse. You could have missed it.
Given the description in Pendragon, that third one's most likely.
It's true. The horses are well described and very important. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's some nice stuff in the adventures, but it did not grab me in. And it may be simply a matter of I would have done it differently.
Yeah, I think the thing that is interesting is that the Pendragon asks you is like you get to participate in King Arthur's, you know, the cycle, right? You know, the death of Arthur. Mm. But like the idea is like we know how that story ends. Like we know the beat, like that is. Mm. And the thing is, so what the starter set is saying is like you're gonna play along, right? Like, yeah, you gotta follow.
There is no option for you to say screw this. I don't want to.
I'm gonna go find Mordred right now, and I'm gonna
or you know, no, yeah. King Lot is clearly right here. Me and the gang, we're gonna join up with King Lot and put a real man on the throne. There's no option for that.
Yeah.
Everybody knows Arthur's the guy.
You do get glory, which is an important, like, not equivalent to experience, but an important, like, reward for player characters for witnessing events, for witnessing pulling him out of the stone, for witnessing him getting the sword from the, you know, the Lady of the Lake and that kind of thing. And so it's a real interesting thing of, like, this is why I don't think I could run Pendragon. Because, yeah, my players would be like, well, we're going to change things. We're going to kill Arthur and replace him, and we're going to do this whole thing.
When Arthur's guard's down, I'm going to stab him and take his place.
Yeah.
I'll be Arthur.
Yeah.
How many people have actually seen his face?
Exactly.
Now that Clarence's out of the stone.
And I think Pendragon works if everybody would be okay with, like, we're going to be participants, but we're not going to change the flow of history because it's written in such
a way.
But like, cause it's about, this is a game. I think that's more of a character study. It's about your own personal journey, your own, like, how do you rise to Arthur's level? Do you live up to his ideals and suffer for them? Or are you going to give in to temptation and become,
or are you the guy that Arthur's just shaking his head at sadly?
Yeah. Are you going to disappoint Arthur?
It's like, okay, you know, here's the continuum Pendragon crossover. Is that you are time travelers who know how it all plays out. You go along or you disrupt things. And what this immediately made me think about was so many angry internet comments of the mid White Wolf aberrant era. And people were livid at the idea of meta plot, which was that, okay, each book that White Wolf publishes advances a meta plot that the characters can't change. And that, you know, I'm just watching this fight between their superhero and their supervillain. And I can't, you know, I can maybe get a few swings in on one side or the other, but the end is preordained. I'm impotent. I can't change this plot. I can't do anything to Kane in Vampire. I can't do anything to Divis Mull in Aberrant. I'm just some dude on the periphery. And so, I mean, it would be like if you were going to play the great Star Wars campaign and it's like, okay, so Are you going to help Gold Leader, or are you going to disobey his orders and yell at him for turning off his targeting computer? And I can see how that could be a real drag.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, at the same time, the unique setting of Arthurian, where things do feel so preordained, or, you know, ordained by fate or God or what have you, where people, as tragic heroes, can't escape their destinies, or, you know, are just alternately, oh, well, you know, this, he's a good one. He's going to come through in the end no matter what, because his traits, which you set, you the player set, but the dice play around with, it's like, yeah, he is not going to escape from the fact that at his core, he is honest and valorous, because you decided you wanted his fate to be honest and valorous. By the way, James, I looked at the intro adventure and I'm like, damn, James is right. Page 3, those columns aren't balanced. So that, you've infected me with that. Sorry, congratulations.
Man. It's one of those. It's like the future conditional. Once you're looking for, once you're aware of it, you can't stop.
It's like a kick in the shins. So again, we're back to my friend's argument that this deprotagonizes you. It's like, okay, I'm going to be along for the ride while Arthur rises to power. And if the dice say that I'm a brave, loyal, noble knight, then I will be. But if the dice say that I'm suspicious, lying coward, then, well, I guess I'm going to get to play through that and watch him deal with Pelennor.
You need to be a player who enjoys seeing their character in, like suffer, like to go through some shit, like not to win, but to like have conflict.
A character who does the right thing because they know it's the right thing, even though it's the wrong thing for that situation, and suffer the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably love this. I can absolutely see people. I can absolutely imagine players who would hate this and not be in any way objectively wrong. It's just like, you know, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to have to play the role of a tragic character brought low by his hubris or whatever. I want to be in the driver's seat instead of sometimes just having to accept that I'm shotgun.
There's other games for that. Like, this is not that game.
Certainly. And I'm sure there's a I haven't read the Great Pendragon campaign. How determined is the end?
That's it. Like, yeah, we'd have to read that. Like, I mean, I think you could also do a campaign once the full book comes out of just like, you could probably put the Arthur stuff like in the background, right? Your knight's questing in King Arthur's reigning, and we're just going to say he's going to reign for a long time. So we're not going to worry about the beginning or the end of Arthur's life or his journey. We're going to worry about your knights and what they're doing.
I mean, in intensely perverse edgelord that I still in many ways am, I would be tempted to run the Court of King Lot campaign. Mm-hmm. And I would present it from, you know, front to back. Arthur's wrong. Arthur's bad. He's a bad king. He's not right for
England. Who is this whelp?
Yeah.
You know, what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why is Merlin the son of the literal devil so fired up to get him on the throne? That's not suspicious to you? It's suspicious to me.
Well, one thing we should also mention is that the character folios, one thing this edition does, I don't know about previous edition, is it's like there's not just like male knights, female knights, there's also pagan knights. You have a diversity of options for characters, like not just household knights, but mercenary knights as well. So you could make, you could do like the 13th Age as a camp, or not the 13th Age, the 13th Knight, the Antonio Banderas movie, where he went to the 13th Viking. 13th Warrior. Yeah. Sorry. There's a lot of 13ths. So you could do a lot of different types of sagas or campaigns set in this area. And you could do outsider knights. You could do knights who don't fit in, knights who
Appendix E in the book three is mercenary and household knights and the difference between them. You know, mercenary knights who do not have loyalty to any particular lord, all the rest of that. And, you know, it's been done in other games. Dragon Warriors, which I used to publish, the idea was that basically the fighter class in that, who are called knights, you'd come back from the Crusades. These were not our Crusades. It was a holy war. But they'd come back to discover there were no jobs for them, so they were just roaming the countryside looking for whatever work or meat or money they could get their hands on, which worked really well as a piece of background setup. But it's completely foregrounded here. It's in the starter set. It's that important enough to make the distinction between you don't have to swear loyalty to an existing lord. You can just be wandering the countryside. There's references in the adventure itself to robber knights, knights who have gone to the dark side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it talks about like high glory, low honor knights that are like very skilled or powerful, but also like given to their, you know, worse, they're vengeful or they're lustful traits or they're cruel traits, you know, rather than merciful, for example. So yeah, you could totally play that. And like that's something to explore, but
one of the sample knights is a pagan woman, and I'm like, okay, good times. And she's the one who's like, why would I not use a bow? What do you mean it's dishonorable?
Yeah,
it kills people. It's great.
James, I think you're really right, like bringing up like the tragedy aspect of it. Like, this is a game of tragedy. Like, it is a game of like being trying to do something good, trying, like, you also have to think about like how much things sucked back in the 6th century, how much things sucked. Like,
yeah,
peasants were very poor and knights could kill a peasant without consequence. Like, everyone had to follow certain laws. Like, it was a very brutal and harsh life. And like, Arthur's idea was like, maybe we should make things not suck as much. People were willing to die for that. People were willing to do everything for that vision. And at the core, this is a game about
life doesn't have to be trash.
Yeah.
Sounds fake, but I'm in.
Yeah, exactly. And that's are you going to rise to that call? And like, I'm really interested to read the campaign now, too, because I want to see what other kind of adventures, because the adventures here aren't just like, they're not dungeon crawls, right? There's a jousting tournament. They have rules for that. They have like, there's a mass combat system, and they also have like, let's establish relations with other kingdoms, which are just like that county over there. Like, it's just like within a horse, you know, with a couple days journey on horseback. So things were very small. There weren't as many people back then. And like, it's everything is much smaller in a lot of ways. Like, you just, a few gold coins, you know, a few horses, a few weapons. That's all you had to deal with, and that's if you were well off.
Yeah, and though the initial adventure it's quite railroady, as you would expect. This is the starter set. What it's showing you is the tone and style of how adventures work and the sort of encounters. And there's some great moral choices. There's some horribly obvious ones. There's one where a bunch of peasants come up to you and go, "Do you want to help us rob someone?"
Asking you to help them rob is the guy who just ripped you off.
Yes. Do you want to help us rob this asshole? But the game just makes it kind of clear that if you do that, then essentially that's game over. Yes, you get some money. No, you completely fail the rest of the mission. But the rest of it, yes, it's railroady. Yes, it's kind of intro level. Yes, there's a weird emphasis on battles. There's a lot of battles going on in this. And the battle system I have issues with it because it didn't feel, it's not the way I would have done it. I will stop saying that.
It doesn't feel as smooth. Is this an old Stafford design, or is this something that got tipped in later? Because it doesn't have that sort of glossy, smooth, mechanical feel that the character stuff seemed to have.
It's clever. I don't. I mean, the last time I read an edition of Pendragon was in the 90s. I don't remember the battle system, but that's a while ago. Yeah, I agree. It doesn't feel as smooth, and it's a scripted battle system as well. It's not purely random, but it doesn't feel, again, like your characters being foregrounded or necessarily important in what they're doing. And it does feel like the outcome is probably preordained.
Well, in the starter, the sword campaign, it says these battles in this adventure, the end is preordained. In other ones, it may be anybody's ball game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yes.
That there we're back to the, well, are you okay with the advantage of an Arthurian game is that everybody knows what it means and how it goes.
Mm.
The disadvantage of playing in an Arthurian game is that everybody knows how it goes and what it means. And you can't customize it very easily. Once you meet Mordred, your players are going to be this motherfucker. Mm-hmm. Well, we know he's bad. And that is, on one hand, you know, okay, great. We're all on the same page. Mordred's bad. How do we thwart his wiles? And on the other hand, it's the deprotagonizing meta plot complaint is that maybe I want to like Mordred. Maybe I like the cut of Mordred's jib. Maybe I think Mordred would be a better king. He seems to be of managerial
timber.
I can fix Mordred.
That's
brilliant.
Oh. I'm gonna remember that. The point I was
we need to make that a bumper sticker.
Yeah, James.
The point I was making about the adventures is they are big scale. It's the stuff mm-hmm. you are doing is altering the fate of kingdoms and possibly the country as a whole. No major spoiler. It takes you up to the moment where Arthur gets Excalibur. It's eventful stuff, and it's following the established traditional retelling of the first part of the Arthurian cycle, which is very much about him unifying the country first of all, getting people to admit that he's king, and then unifying the country to see off the Saxons, pretty much, and other external threats. And it does, yeah. Even though sometimes you're sitting in the, it feels like you're in the second row rather than the front row as player characters, the stuff that you, when you get to do stuff, it does feel like this stuff is important and it matters, and the decisions you have to make are often quite big decisions.
I mean, a lot of the stuff is very cool.
Yes.
In the solo game, it's like, okay, do you stand up to King Lot knowing that you're just some snot nose, and if he decks you, you're going to stay decked? And it's like, no, fuck that guy. Standing up for my friend Arthur is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I got decked. But Arthur remembered.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is you're never going to be the front row because, like, the front row is King Arthur. Like, those are named characters and you can't, yeah. Like, yeah, you're never, you know, like, I want to play Star Wars right along, you know, well, okay, unless you want to literally play Luke and Han, like, then there's, like, other spotlight characters and you have to acknowledge that. Or we have to play in an entirely different section of the galaxy.
As the game designer, I'm like, okay, how would you play a game where it's like, okay, one of you is going to be Arthur and one of you is going to be Lancelot. And if as Lancelot, you choose to do Lancelot stuff like sleep with Guinevere, mm-hmm. you will get all kinds of Lancelot advantages. But if you choose to not do Lancelot stuff,
mm-hmm.
if you choose to go rogue, it's not going to be the nice, tidy succession of events. It's going to fall to the dice, and those guys are crazy.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to play a cowardly conservative Arthur, do it, and let's see how that alternate universe plays out.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think a parallel universe version, or, you know, a not entirely beholden to the traditional storyline version would be really interesting.
Well, I mean, it says at the beginning, it's like, this is not a exact mimicry of any one version of the Arthurian myth. And it, you know, it's like, here are different versions. Here's A, here's B, here's C. I liked this about A, liked this about C, you know, and I've put in some other stuff from, you know, some from myth, some from history, some from pop culture. you know, just trying to get it to be its own version of, its own variant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And bits of it are very familiar, or almost familiar. There is the encounter with Sir Pellinore, which, if you know Arthur, you'll go, oh, yes, that. And if you know Monty Python, the Holy Grail, you'll be going, oh, the Black Knight. Okay. It pings our memories of almost folk memories, or almost, you know, particularly if you're British, this stuff's ingrained
because here it comes.
There's a lot of it around. There is also a footnote, a moment where in the adventure where you go up, the player characters are given some pre-written questions and pre-written answers from a peasant. The pre-written question is, what's your name, old timer? And the old timer responds, just call me old timer, I guess. On behalf of the people of England, no, fuck off. Nobody talks like that here. We don't do that. But that was the only moment in this game I hated. Everything else, apart from the length of the combat system, I really liked.
The combat system or the battle system?
The combat system, there's a bloody great table in the middle of it. And yes, this is a first generation role-playing game. And it has excuses, but this is the sixth edition of a first edition role-playing, a first generation role-playing game. And surely we could have designed big tables in the middle of combat systems out of the games by now. You know, it's, and the battle system, I felt, put the emphasis in a slightly odd direction. I didn't hate it. I wouldn't use it myself if I was running this stuff as a campaign. I would tweak it, but it's perfectly functional. It does work. There's some very nice ideas in there. I didn't hate it. Mm-hmm. But just that moment of dialogue was, oh dear. Footnote to something, I can't remember where I was going back to. Yes, it's, as British people, we know this stuff on, I hate to say, a deeper level, but it's almost ingrained. You know, you can go to Glastonbury, you can go and see the round table or a round table in Winchester.
It's okay, James, you can say this, and you know, Ross and I will just accept that we understand McDonald's jingles in a way you never will.
I'll give you that one. But it feels familiar in a way, whether it's from Disney movies or from stories that you heard when you were young, or from your vague memory of the DC Comics series Camelot 3000 with amazing Brian Bolland artwork that came out in late 80s, I think. It was just absolute futuristic retelling that shouldn't have worked and yet did, partly because it was Brian Bolland artwork. Yeah, there's a resonance in here which the game captures, whether it's narratively within the adventure or mechanically within the system and just on the character sheet. It feels Arthurian. Mm-hmm. And if I have the gripes I've mentioned are moments where it just doesn't quite feel Arthurian, but it never goes off track for very long.
But there are those moments where you just get a frisson, where you're just like, yeah, that would be such a cool moment in play.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Just,
you know, it's
just
like, yeah. Oh, I'm going to blow the whistle and summon the werewolves to battle. And it doesn't, and that does not have the feel of like how White Wolf would handle that moment, or how any other game would handle that moment. You know that if you did it in Pendragon, it would have that mythic sense to it. Even if it's mechanized, it exists in a context that elevates it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. To a degree, this is impossible to review without actually playing a campaign with it, because if there's ever been a game that has been like more focused on campaign play that we've talked about, I don't know, like, because again, like, it's, I think the depths of this game you only experience after, like, you know, 10 or 20 sessions in, and you start feeling the dynastic elements, the generational elements, the weight of
once your current character is thinking about how disappointed his father, who was your previous character, would be in him, then you're really
Dragon. Yeah. I mean, it's a game about chivalry and the tragedy of chivalry. Like, can you live these impossible ideals in this brutal time? What price will they enact on your knight? And like, how do you deal with that? Like, Because I think it's about like living up to an ideal that you can't live up to. Like it's something beyond.
Try not to fail, fail, continue to try.
Which I mean, again, it's like a metaphor for Christianity. Like we are flawed
and the human condition, frankly. I'll add something else that struck me about the mechanics as I was reading them and working out how they worked and playing the solo game is that a lot of designs, and in my own designs, there is a desire to do something flashy and showy and new. And it's like, oh, hey, check out this cool ass trick. Mm-hmm. You know, this game is based entirely on your driver's license. It's a cool trick. You don't need dice or a character sheet.
Identity fraud, the role-playing game.
Identity fraud, the role-playing game. Whereas this, being old enough and having its legacy and ongoing level of success and its history, it's like, I don't have to do anything fancy. I just have to be good. I don't have to draw attention by standing out from the crowd. I am the crowd. And it has this purity would be hard to match if you were just starting over in the year of our Lord 2023, you know, starting from jump. Are there any other Arthurian games? There must be, but I can't think of a one.
Nothing like this. I think there's like games set in King Arthur's myth, but like GURPS, like a GURPS book is probably out there. There's a GURPS book for everything.
Yeah. I mean, there is Mutants in Avalon. But,
We did just mention that. Yeah.
I'm not sure that I would consider Mutants in Avalon to be a direct competitor with Pen.
Well, it's out of print, I think.
And I no longer receive royalties on it. So, yeah, I would.
Consign it to the fire, James.
It was literally my first supplement, my first book-length gig in the industry. Yeah, I think the closest thing is Ars Magica, because Ars Magica is very much what if Pendragon, but wizards.
Yeah.
And you have to remember there are several editions of Pendragon that do not have wizards as playable characters and don't even, you know, there's not even an explanation of how magic works. I've never talked to...
I like that. I would... If I was running this and someone said, I want to be a wizard, I'd be like, I want to be 6'4" and have a great free throw percentage, but we don't always get what you want. What's your knight going
to
be like?
Yeah, you're going to be a knight. Yeah. Like this is a game about being a knight and trying to live up to chivalry. It's not about anything else.
You want to be a wizard? You can be a pagan knight. That's as close as you're going to get.
Yeah, but I feel like the appeal of the Arthurian myth cycle, like, again, the central theme of, like, I am going to do, we're going to band together and bring peace to the land and like make and be better. And like, and no matter what the cost to ourselves that heroism is something that appeals to people. Like, you know, in a world where every like superhero is world weary and cynical and biting jokes,
Well, this is what I was saying. Yeah. It's the age of the smartass.
Yeah, but like it's
very hard to be sincere in the 21st century. And, you know, the Arthurian myth exists before the advent of sarcasm.
Well, but like I just recently encountered like something that actually reminded me of King Arthur's cycle, which was Zelda Tears of the Kingdom, which has a plot about fighting evil, saving a princess, and there's actually they're called sages in the game, but you literally have a scene where a group of people come to a round table and swear a vow to their king to defend the kingdom against evil. And like the whole game has a very sincere view of heroism. Link has to do these impossible things to save the day. And, you know, he fights. And so does Zelda. Zelda has her own quests she has to do. And like, it's a whole thing. So I feel like there still is an appeal there. Like the drama is there. It's just.
Or is it just the robust crafting system?
You have to. I think you kind of have to go on your own quest to really get something out of Pendragon. Like, you have to, like, go on this long campaign to really get into it. Like, even a three session mini thing of the starter set isn't enough. So I feel like maybe, if anything, for the next season, if the full game comes out, we could revisit it. Because I feel like the dynamic, like, we're only getting half the game, right? We're literally only getting half the game with the starter set. So, but what I see there, I can see it, but like, I don't feel it yet, because like, God, you have to immerse yourself so much to really get the full experience. But like, obviously there's something there, because otherwise why would they keep why would they keep making new additions? Like, why would it have this like passion that these the player base has for it? So yeah.
To drag it back to comics briefly, it reminds me of Astro City, which
Kurt Busiek.
Astro City's brilliant, and it's so great, and it's so smart, and it's so clever and beautiful. And like every few years, it's a different publisher. And it's like it started at one publisher that couldn't make it economically viable to continue. And then some other publisher's like, well, it's so great and smart. Surely it will make it great, smart, and profitable. And then they try. And then a few years again, someone's like, well, those first two didn't really grasp Astro City. So I'm going to take it, and it's going to be this huge thing that will be smart and beautiful and profitable. And then it's had, how many publishers has it had? And, at some point you maybe have to accept that it's not failing economically in spite of being brilliant and beautiful. It may be failing economically because it's brilliant and beautiful. So I'm happy to see something like Pendragon that is brilliant and beautiful and apparently, hopefully, economically viable at all as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be great if we didn't have to think about the money when we consider how good a game is, but this is the cage we built for ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, it looks to me as if Chaosium are giving it the same treatment that they're giving Call of Cthulhu. There's this beautiful starter set. There will be a big revision of the rules, which will probably be a, multi-volume edition stretching several hundred pages. Exhaustive, nicely done. Some people will say there's too much of it, that it's too detailed, really the true edition is, you should go back to the first edition, which you can still buy for $8 or even less on DriveThru. I think you can buy a whole bunch of different editions, probably all of them, many of them, for about $8 if you really want to do the full compare and contrast, and if you've got the time to read them all.
I'm good.
But yeah, I mean, I would have loved to have talked more about the great Pendragon campaign, which I did read 20 years ago when we gave it the almost 20 years ago. It's a 430-page book, 377 pages of which are adventure material, pretty much. And it covers the whole thing. As some of the earlier editions of Pendragon do, it starts not with Arthur becoming king, or it starts with Uther Pendragon and working through all of that. So you get the background. And that's really where the dynastic stuff comes in, because by the time you get to Arthur, there's a good chance that your father has lived through the periods of disarray and England just being a bunch of warring kingdoms. The anarchy period. It's a fantastic setup. I think it's almost worth picking up the rules or a version of the rules only to play the Great Pendragon campaign. And yes, it's a story that you and many of your players will already know, but it's still one of the great stories, and it will not be told to you in the same way that you necessarily remember. And this is one of the interesting things about the Once and Future King, the T.H. White book as well, which I read through a few years ago, expecting to know it kind of as a refresher, and I really didn't. And White's, what he does with viewpoints and with the characters and your expectations is masterful. Book one is very much, it's kind of a book version of The Sword in the Stone, the movie, only with fewer songs. But that's where the great transformative battles and Arthur becoming different kinds of animals to learn about the world, that's where all of that comes from. But books two, three, and four are just extraordinary. And I had my breath taken away on a regular basis reading it. And the Great Pendragon campaign, clearly it's inspired by that, but it's inspired by all of it. But it will do the same thing for your appreciation of one of the world's great mythic cycles. And then there are people who will, whether they go through that or they'll just read the new Pendragon rules and go, this is my game. This is, it does so much. Yes, it's a first-generation role-playing system, and still its roots are clearly buried in that. Yes, you have five attributes. You have skills. BRP was always probably the best of the early, very early role-playing systems, but it's still an early role-playing system. But it works. My God, it works. And it's a bit like driving a classic car. It may not be as swifty and as purely narratively designed as some of the modern systems, but it still goes like smoke, leaving clouds of smoke behind it as it goes. But wow. It's a long time since I've read a system of mechanics smiling the whole way through, but there's an elegance to this. I mean, if you've heard the name Greg Stafford and you've never quite understood why he's held in such reverence, pretty much any of the editions of Pendragon will teach you why. But and he will always be remembered for RuneQuest. RuneQuest was his life's work. It was what he put most time into. When he split away from Chaosium back in the day, he founded Isseries to republish RuneQuest, not Pendragon. But as a piece of design, my God, Pendragon, what it did for the industry, what it showed the industry was possible with role-playing games in the mid-80s. And at the same time, you know, Greg Kostikian over at Chaosium, over at West End, was doing amazing stuff with the Star Wars role-playing game, with the Ghostbusters RPG. But in terms, those are, they're beautiful at capturing a particular cinematic style. Greg is capturing a literary style, a story, a style of pure storytelling. And it is a work of genius and great beauty.
Meanwhile, all the fans are like, how many of these guys are named Greg?
A lot of Gregs. James, earlier, when we were prepping for this episode, you linked to a series of blog posts on Chaosium talking about what they did to prepare for 6th edition and like what are the differences between this and the previous editions. And I was struck by like showing like one of the first blog posts, a photo of a marked up copy of the death of author that Greg Stafford did and like was writing handwritten notes of like, oh, this is like this game mechanic right here. And like, this is this and like, aha, like he was like reverse engineering game mechanics from the texts, like figuring out like what the text was about and then making a game based on like the themes of the text, which is also no one else, like there aren't like RPGs on like Moby Dick, right? There's not like an RPG on the adventures of a Huckleberry Finn in the same regard. Like there isn't this kind of this unity I'm talking about between theme and mechanics. And like, I don't think anything else is really, I can't think of anything off the top of my head of like ensemble cast and episodic adventures. Like King Arthur is like we're talking about the role-playing game coming from, you know, all these sources. I don't know. It's just a fascinating to look at all of these influences coming off of each other and creating new systems and games. And it's something to look at as a game designer, if nothing else, because you can see just the approach and you can kind of like reverse engineer how, if you read the books and looked at the game, you're like, oh, okay, here's how it happened. And here's where Greg Stafford was coming from. And it's very helpful.
This was a great moment. Here's how it was transformed into rules mimicry form.
Yep. And it's great.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I can't wait for the full game to come out. And I'm tempted to get the PDF of the previous version of the Pendragon campaign, which is on DriveThruRPG. To just read through it just to see what it was like. They're obviously working on a new version of the campaign as well, I think, as the
they would the be fools book. Not to.
Yeah. Yeah. So, So it's a great way to end the season too.
It's genuinely one of the great role-playing games.
And Greg Stafford came up with your game idea, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. So you'll just have to deal with that. We all have to deal with that as game designers. It's just a universal experience. Like, oh, this is good. Oh, no, yeah, he did it already. Yep. Oh.
Stafford.
Because,
he's always one step ahead of me.
I mean, Greg, I looked at the first thought I had is looking after the character folio. I was like, oh, this is a dirty world. Oh, wait, no.
Yeah.
Drake Stafford beat you to the punch there, Drake. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Dirty world has certain nuances to it. But yeah, I'm, hey, you know, I'm like, if I'm thinking like Greg Stafford did, I must be doing something right, maybe.
It's true. Yeah, you could do a lot worse.
I could do a lot worse.
We're actually technically not done with season two. We do have one more episode, but yeah, sorry, James.
I was just going to say, I didn't know Greg well, but I did know him. And I think if you took his mechanical designs and used them somewhere else, he would have been delighted.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, great artist steal. and yeah, Greg Stafford stole from the death of Arthur, so why not steal yourself?
So
thank you all so much for listening. We do have one more episode, but this will be an actual play of not Pendragon, but the game we have not reviewed yet, Dungeon Crawl Classics. We have talked about it briefly on the Metacurrency episode, for example, but this will be a peasant funnel adventure where Greg, James, and two guests will be playing in a adventure. I run it'll be a published adventure, it'll be fun. And then after that, we will start work on season three for a Kickstarter. Hopefully later this year. Should be a lot of fun. And we'll be, because in season three, we'll be talking about adventures, at least in part. So we'll start season three with a episode zero about the published adventure we ran through in season two. So we'll be talking quite a bit about peasant funnels in the near future. we're looking at the other side of the Pendragon, the unwashed peasants. Trying to get by. Thank you all for listening, and be sure to check out letternarrativedistance.com for show notes and links to all these cool things. And we have a Discord. We'll have a link in the show notes where you can talk about it, this episode and all the others. All right. Thank you.